Well, this is Phil Davidson, and with me today is Rockford Symphony Orchestra Music Director Stephen Larson, and we are discussing the RSO's Classics 2 concert, Mozart's Requiem and His Final Year, on Saturday, November 9th, 7:30 p.m. at the Coronado Performing Arts Center. Well, this concert is indeed all Mozart all the time.
Yep.
Everything you will hear on November 9th comes from the, shall I call him, the divine Mr. M.
That works. Yep. Okay.
but let's clear something up right from the beginning. Enlighten us on what I might refer to as the Amadeus ploy, or as Inspector Clouseau would say. Let's talk about Mozart's name, or should I say names?
Okay. He was, let's see if I can remember all this. His baptismal name was, and it was Latin for the most part, Wolfgangus Theosophilus Wolfgangus Chrysostomus Theosophilus Mozart.
Oh, my.
And the Chrysostom, presumably referring to St. John Chrysostom, if you prefer, nobody ever used, including Mozart. The Theophilus, Greek for God, God-loving, is translated into Italian, into Latin as Amadeus, and into Italian as Amadei. And over the years, it's become very fashionable to call him Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. But in fact, I don't want to say never, but he almost never used that name. When he used his middle name, he called himself Wolfgang Amadei Mozart, or simply Wolfgang Mozart. So I've consciously refrained from referring to him in print as Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. Either call him W.A. Mozart or just Wolfgang Mozart. There's no possibility of mixing him up with anybody else. There are no Wolfgang Q. Mozarts out there. There's only one.
All right. Now we got that cleared up. The concert on November 9th begins with the overture to Mozart's opera, The Magic Flute. One description says that in this piece, Mozart creates a musical world unlike any other. How so?
In so many ways. This is such a marvelous piece of music in every sense. September 30th, it was his debut of his last year, September 30th, 1791, just a couple of months before he died. He manages to combine elements of fantasy, elements of romance, elements of high idealism, and yet tunefulness and hummability, and all combining that with extraordinarily high compositional technique, an amazing compositional technique. I don't think anybody has ever written anything that is so simple on its face and yet so complicated beneath its surface. And you don't need to be sucked in by either extreme. You could either listen to this piece, the overture or the opera, as simply a pleasant piece of music to listen to, or you can listen to it for the great symbolism that's involved in it, or you can do both.
Well, now, I think Beethoven described the Magic Flute as one of the marvels of the age, I believe.
Yeah, and I don't know exactly what he was referring to, but I would think it would be that combination of high virtues, low humor at times, just popular tunefulness and exquisite compositional craft, and all done seemingly effortlessly by this incredible man who I don't think ever wrote a bad piece of music.
Now, I know that Mozart was a very active Freemason. Mm-hmm. Are there symbols of of the Masonic Rite in the Magic Flute?
There have been books written about the symbols of the Masonic Rite in the Magic Flute. And some of them get very, very esoteric and are very buried, but some of them are extremely obvious. The number three is very important in Masonry, and the threes are all over the place. We start with the overture. Well, the key of the opera, the overture begins and ends in the key of E flat major. There are three flats in the key signature of E flat major. It begins with three fanfares, chords at the beginning, and there are three fanfares in the middle of the overture. Again, there's the number three, and also the pattern, the rhythmic pattern of the fanfare corresponds to the knock, the ritual knock of the initiate of the Masonic ritual. There are three ladies, there are three spirits, there are symbols of light and darkness. The piece is just ridden with it. A lot of people would have known this at the time. Masonry was fairly common. A lot of very prominent people were Freemasons. Some people make a big deal about this being secret. Most are exposing secrets, but they were pretty well-known secrets at the time. They were not, now that you know this, I have to kill you, that kind of a thing. But there are also secrets or symbols that... even if you don't know what they mean, you kind of perceive them. You see that they're there. You can't escape the number three, and you can't escape the light and the darkness in the opera, and the movement from darkness to light. That they're all part of the and knowledge and wisdom, virtue, being part of the Masonic creed, are very much apparent in this opera throughout.
Now, the concert, moving on, the concert features two other compositions created in the last 5 months of Mozart's short life. The first is the Clarinet Concerto in A Major, and I believe that was his final instrumental composition.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
It's my understanding that the piece was written for a rather well-known clarinetist at the time. So tell us about that clarinetist, and then how and why this concerto didn't seem to survive in the form that Mozart wrote it.
Anton Stadler, I think it's Anton, I might be messing up his first name now, was a virtuoso clarinetist. And this was, you have to understand, the clarinet is something of a new instrument at this time. The early Mozart symphonies, the early Haydn symphonies don't use clarinets because they really weren't very common. They had been around for about a century. But their acceptance, their use was sort of slow in coming. And when they were used, when they began to be more popular, it was a wonderfully useful instrument, beautiful, lyrical, silky tone, great flexibility, much easier, much more flexible than the oboe, for instance, its neighbor in the woodwind section. And with this tone that could go from almost inaudible to very full and very present and from very low to very high, almost effortlessly. But this was an instrument that was still in transition. People were still building them and improving on them. The clarinet that Mozart wrote this for was called a basset clarinet. And it had a lower register than today's B-flat or A clarinets. And that was very much a part of this piece. Stadler, by the way, featured very prominently in a number of Mozart's other compositions. His clarinet quintets, quartet. There's some very prominent clarinet parts written for clarinet solo in his final opera, La Clemenza di Tito, which were written for Stadler. And he wrote this concerto for him in October of 1791. We're not exactly sure when the first performance was. It was probably in October, but there really aren't records of it. And there really isn't. There's the score, the autograph score, has been destroyed somehow. Mm. Sometime after Mozart's death, the clarinet the concerto was edited to make it playable on what was becoming the standard clarinet, what we now know as the modern clarinet. So some of the lower passages were taken out and given to the upper register. But it's considered to be today by modern clarinetists the clarinet concerto. If you audition as a clarinetist for an orchestra or for a job anywhere, you are going to play the Mozart clarinet concerto, or at least a movement of it. It's just required. It's standard. It's not easy. It shows every flaw, as any Mozart concerto does. If you got any flaws, any problems in your playing, it's going to come out when you play Mozart. But it's become the standard clarinet concerto. And it's one of his, well, probably the third to the last piece. I think it's, K624, if I remember correctly. Something like that. And 626 is the Requiem, the final piece.
So can you give us a description of what we will experience with this musical piece?
First of all, you may or may not notice that there are no oboes in the orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
And oboes are almost from the very, very beginning of orchestras. The first woodwind instruments to be added to a string orchestra were oboes. And they're absent here because the piercing quality of the instrument is at odds, or at least in opposition to the very, very smooth quality of the clarinet. So rather than have them compete or call attention to the fact that they are very different, he decided just to leave the oboes out entirely.
Well, let's move on to the final composition that you will be performing, written by Mozart. It also was in the last 5 months of his life, and that's Requiem in D minor. I believe that the Requiem was a commissioned work, and there is something about a strange messenger in connection with this commission. Can you shed any light on that?
Well, let's start with the facts, just the facts. Sometime in late spring, early summer, we don't know exactly when. Some people claim that they know when, but no, we don't know when. A messenger came to Mozart and said that an anonymous commissioner wanted Mozart to write a Requiem Mass, for which he would be paid very well. He was given a down payment and told that he would check back with him and see how the progress was going. That, depending on what story you listen to, that became a mysterious man dressed all in gray or all in black. Who this person was, we don't know. It turns out we know who the commissioner was. It was a Count Franz von Walsegg-Stupach. How's that for a name?
Yeah.
Who lived some distance from Vienna. His wife, his 20-year-old wife, had died. And he wanted to commission a Requiem in her memory to be performed a year after the date of her death, anniversary of her death. But he wanted it done anonymously. He didn't want to reveal his identity to Mozart. This is because this man, he was a dilettante amateur musician, and he had a somewhat charming but somewhat disreputable habit of taking music written by other composers and not necessarily telling people, "I wrote this," but when they would ask other musicians, "Did you write this?" he would kind of blush and turn away.
I
he
see.
Would not really admit to it one way or the other. But it became fairly well known, at least retrospectively, that he was doing this quite a bit. And so he had commissioned Mozart, Mozart's reputation was all over Europe as one of the greatest composers of the day. He commissioned Mozart to write this piece and was going to pay him well, and fully expected that nobody would probably ever hear the piece again after it was performed for the anniversary of his wife's death.
Well, now I understand there are several stories and tales about what went on as Mozart tried to complete the Requiem during his final days.
Oh, there are many, and again, indeed, back to the mysterious stranger. The story is that Mozart began to feel that this was a harbinger of his death, and he was writing his own Requiem. And this is somewhat, I think this has been romanticized a bit. When Mozart returned from writing his last opera, the commission of the La Clemenza di Tito in Prague in August, in September, he was in August there in August to write the piece. When he returned, he was exhausted and not in good health. And by November, he was getting worse. And by November 20th, he was bedridden for the rest of his couple of weeks, the rest of his life, until dying on December 5th. He had started to write the Requiem probably shortly it was after commissioned, maybe May or June, did a lot of work on it then. And other projects had come into, that had been more important, but he began working on it diligently in October and November. But it was going to be a substantial piece of music. He was running out of time. He ultimately, sort of cutting to the end of the story, he died before it was completed. And he was owed a lot of money for the completion, or at least his widow was owed a lot of money for the completion, and she desperately needed this money and wanted the piece completed, delivered to the commissioner, and so she could have that money. So now the question is what to do about it. There were some sketches for the music that was left undone. He'd been working very closely with a student of his, Franz Anton Süssmayr, and Süssmayr knew a lot of Mozart's thoughts about what was happening, what was going to be happening, or what should happen, and there were some notes as to what was going to happen with subsequent movements. But then the problem happened, what do we do now to get this piece completed so that Constanza can get the rest of the money? Now, ultimately, this was delivered in March to the Count and with Mozart's forged signature on it, and the money was collected. And you can understand that Constanza, in getting this piece finished and put together in whatever way possible, didn't want to let out a whole lot of details about what had happened with this. She wanted to keep this as undercover as possible. So we do know that from various records that over the next couple of weeks and months, she went to several different composers who were friends of Mozart's and asked them to complete this or complete that or write that. And some of them declined. Some of them did a little bit and said, oh, I can't really do any more. Ultimately, it fell on Süssmayr to do the completion. The question is, how much did he do? Well, according to Constanza, he did a lot. Because at a later date, when she came out with the whole story about the completion of the Requiem, when she was out of legal jeopardy, shall we say, she said that Süssmayr essentially completed a big, big chunk of the piece. And we knew that he did because he wasn't a really good, very good composer, and he made a lot of mistakes, a lot of errors in voice leading, errors in harmony that Mozart never would have done, and also just completed some things rather clumsily in a way that you just know that this was not Mozart's intention. But subsequent scholarship, really digging into this piece, suggests that maybe there was more Mozart in this than we knew about it, at least the skeleton, because one of the things about Süssmayr's own compositions, which weren't really very good, is that Süssmayr did not carry through motivic correlations between movements. He was very much of the school, which many people were at the time, that if you had a melody, you used it, and the next movement came around, you used something else. You just started all over again, just completely new material. Mozart, however, was of the habit of taking material and transforming it and reusing it to keep a thematic unity to the piece. And you find all sorts of thematic unity in the latter movements of this piece that if Süssmayr actually did this, it was the first time in his life he ever did. Mm. So no, probably Mozart had something to do with this. And subsequently, there have been various little sketches and pieces of paper that have come up in fairly recent years that have shown that Mozart actually did a little bit more work, or at least wrote down some ideas, and probably at some point at the keyboard with Süssmayr said, this is what I want to have happen here. And Süssmayr took notes and took it from there. We would probably know more about this except that Constanze and her husband, who she married after Mozart's death, destroyed a lot of Mozart's sketches in about, 1799, I think. So where there could have been more light on this subject, there wasn't. From the very beginning, people recognized that in this version that there were some things that just were really unsatisfactory. Besides the mistakes, I mentioned the voice leading problems, there were just things like at the end of the Lacrimosa, for instance. Lacrimosa is the section that ends the long sequence that begins with the Dies Irae. There's an amen at the end of that. That traditionally, in the performance practice of the time, would have been given to a fugue. There would have been a fugue there on the amen text. Süssmayr simply uses two chords and finishes it because he wasn't capable of writing an amen. That in the version we're doing, which is by Robert Levin, uses some of Mozart's sketches and finishes that, actually writes a fugue to finish out that section. And I think it's a much better version. It sounds a lot more like Mozart than the original version does.
All right. Now, can you give us a Cliff Notes version of what we will experience with the Requiem?
It's 45 minutes long. Thereabouts. It is written for chorus, SATB chorus, soprano, alto, tenor, and bass soloists, and orchestra, which is very much like the orchestral masses written of the day. There was very common practice. There would be a chorus, there would be soloists. The orchestration is really unique for this piece. I'm not aware of any other orchestra, certainly any other Requiem mass, that uses this particular orchestration. There are no flutes. There are no oboes. There are not any clarinets either. There are basset horns. And the basset horn was a kind of an alto clarinet. They're now obsolete, not to be confused with basset hounds. but they're clarinets that are pitched in F, a fourth below the modern B-flat clarinet. And they're, besides just having the lower register, the tone is actually softer and smoother than the modern clarinet. So this is the top voice of the wind section. The bassoons, there are two bassoons that function very, very heavily in this, but three trombones. Trombones are very commonly used in liturgical music of the era, not so often in other music. Trombones were, especially for the Germans, German-speaking people, they were considered to be sort of the voice of God. So Mozart uses them in Don Giovanni, the final scene, for instance, when Don Giovanni is dragged down to hell, the trombone's playing very prominently there. He uses them in the magic flute in the temple scenes with Zoroastro, the great Zoroastro, to solemnify that music. Here they are used in their traditional mass role to follow along the alto, tenor, and bass lines and reinforce them. But they're also used for their own that solemn, that almost awe-inspiring tone quality that they can get, the three trombones playing together. Two high trumpets and timpani, and of course strings and organ. So the sound is different completely. The style it goes back and forth between movements, between contrapuntal style, voices entering independently of another, and very homophonic style where there's a very clearly identifiable melody, perhaps sung by a single soloist, or sometimes by the whole chorus singing together with the same rhythms, the same words. A lot of variety of textures, but there is a unity to the piece. Again, I've referred to that before. A piece that a unity that holds the piece together that was too carefully planned out to be accidental, to be just something that, let's finish this piece and get paid for it. So Mozart's hand is everywhere in this, even if sometimes he didn't actually write the notes that we're hearing. Some cases he may have. We really don't know. It is a work that I think probably the best way to describe it is solemn. It's not all downcast. It's not all. Some of the movements are very, very bright and very joyous. The Sanctus, 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 for instance. But much of it is a rather severe, strict style that suits itself very, very well to the subject. And when it comes down to it, we can't help but hear this piece thinking not only of the text, the Requiem, grant them rest eternal, Lord, and let perpetual light shine upon them, but be aware of the fact that this was written by a man who died in the middle of completing this piece. And was it, did he perceive this piece as being his own Requiem, as it was reported that he said? We really don't know. My own point of view is that Mozart didn't get very sentimental about anything he wrote and never got terribly emotionally attached to it. It was a piece of music for a purpose, and this purpose was to make money, which is why he always wrote music. That was his way of making a living. So did he do anything special in this piece because he felt that it was his own Requiem? There's no evidence for that. I don't think you can point to any place in the piece and say this is special because Mozart knew it was for himself. Now, everything Mozart wrote was special, and you can't walk away from any piece that he ever wrote and thinking, well, he just scribbled this off in a hurry, didn't he? No, it was all perfect from one note, from the first note to the last.
Tremendous. Well, I suppose we should mention again sound bites.
Yes, you'll get a chance to meet this young clarinetist and to hear about what his life has been like. And frankly, very odd duck, a concert clarinetist. There aren't that many of these people in the world. So, you know, what is he doing? Well, how is he making a living at this? What are his plans? It should be a very interesting conversation.
Great. Well, it's Mozart's Requiem and his final year at the Coronado Performing Arts Center on Saturday, November 9th, 7:30 p.m. during the Rockford Symphony Orchestra's Classics 2 concert. For more information about this concert, sound bites, and more, go to rockfordsymphony.com or call 815-965-0049. This is Phil Davidson.
And this is Steve Larson, music director of the RSO.
Thank you for listening.